straight into my eyes, defying his own words. Even though I refuse to back down, I do let him know I like what he's doing to me. I can't help but let him know that because I don't have control over my voice right now. It's possessed by a girl who thinks she wants this from him. "Don't stop," my voice says, becoming more possessed by him the longer this continues.
"Wasn't planning on it."
He applies more pressure, both inside and outside me. He grabs my leg behind the knee and pulls it up between our chests, finding a slightly different angle to enter me. He holds my leg firmly against his shoulder and somehow thrusts into me even deeper. "Miles, oh my God!" I moan his name and God's name and even shout to Jesus a couple of times. I begin to shudder beneath him, and I'm not sure which one of us broke down first, but we're kissing now. We're kissing as hard and as deep as his thrusts inside me. He's loud. I'm louder. I'm shaking. He's shaking harder. He's out of breath. I'm inhaling enough for both of us. He pushes into me one final time and holds me firmly against the mattress with his weight. "Tate," he says, moaning my name against my mouth as his body recovers from the tremors. "Fuck, Tate." He slowly pulls out of me and presses his cheek against my chest. "Holy shit," he breathes. "It's so good. This. Us. So fucking good." "I know." He rolls onto his side and keeps his arm draped across me. We lie together quietly. Me, not wanting to admit that I just let him use me again. Him, not wanting to admit that it was more than just sex. Both of us lying to ourselves.
"Where's Corbin?" he asks.
"He'll be home later tonight." He lifts his head and looks down at me, his brows furrowed in a line of worry.
"I should go."
He rolls off the bed and pulls his jeans back on.
"Come over later?"
I nod as I stand up and slide into my own jeans. "Grab my shirt from the kitchen," I tell him. I pull on my bra and fasten it. He opens my bedroom door, but he doesn't walk out. He pauses in the doorway. He's looking at someone. Shit. I don't have to see him to know that Corbin is standing there. I immediately rush to the door to stop whatever's about to happen. When I hold it open further, Corbin is standing in his doorway across the hall, glaring at Miles. I make the first move. "Corbin, before you say anything..." He holds up his hand to shut me up. His eyes drop for a second to my bra, and he winces as if he was hoping that what he heard didn't really happen. He looks away, and I immediately cover myself, embarrassed that he heard everything. He looks back at Miles, and his eyes are an equal mixture of anger and disappointment.
"How long?"
"Don't answer that, Miles," I say. "I just want him to leave. Corbin has no right to be questioning him like this. It's ridiculous."
"A while," Miles says shamefully.
Corbin nods slowly, letting it sink in.
"Do you love her?"
Miles and I look at each other. He looks back at Corbin as if he's trying to decide which one of us he wants his answer to please. I'm positive the slow shake of his head pleases neither of us.
"Are you at least planning to?" Corbin asks.
I continue to study Miles as if someone is asking him what the meaning of life is. I think I want his answer to Corbin's question more than Corbin does. Miles exhales and shakes his head again.
"No,"
he whispers. "No. He's not even planning to love me." I knew his answer. I expected it. However, it still hurts like hell. The fact that he can't even lie about it to save himself from disappointing Corbin proves that this isn't some game he's playing. This is Miles. Miles isn't capable of love. Not anymore, anyway. Corbin grips the frame of his door and presses his forehead against his arm, inhaling a slow, steady breath.
He looks back up at Miles with eyes like arrows aimed at a target. In all my life, I've never seen Corbin this angry.
You just fucked my sister?
I'm waiting for Miles to fall backward with the impact of Corbin's words, but he takes a step toward him instead.
Corbin, she's a grown woman.
Corbin takes a quick step toward Miles.
Get out.
Miles glances back at me, and his eyes are apologetic and full of regret. I'm not sure if it's for me or for Corbin, but he does what Corbin asks. He leaves. I'm still standing in my bedroom doorway, looking at Corbin like I could fly across this hall and deck him. Corbin pierces me with a stare as firm as his stance.
You're not a brother, Tate, he says. Don't you dare tell me I'm not allowed to be pissed.
He steps back into his bedroom and slams his door. I blink rapidly, fighting back tears of anger because of Corbin, tears of hurt because of Miles, and tears of shame because of the selfish choices I made for myself. I refuse to cry in front of either of them. I walk to the kitchen and retrieve my shirt, then pull it over my head as I make my way toward the front door and across the hall. I knock on his door and Miles opens it immediately. He looks behind me as if he expects Corbin to be standing there. Then he steps aside and lets me in. He'll get over it, I say to him after he closes his door.
I know, he says quietly. But it won't be the same.
Miles walks to his living room and sits on his couch, so I follow him and sit down beside him. I don't have any words of advice because he's right. Things more than likely won't be the same between him and Corbin. I feel shitty that I'm the reason for that. Miles sighs as he pulls my hand to his lap. He threads his fingers through mine.
Tate, he says. I'm sorry.
I look at him, and his eyes come up and meet mine. For what? I don't know why I'm pretending not to know what he's talking about. I know exactly what he's talking about.
When Corbin asked if I planned on loving you, he says. I'm sorry I couldn't say yes. I just didn't want to lie to either of you.
I shake my head. You've been nothing but honest about what you want from me, Miles. I can't be mad at you for that. He inhales a deep breath as he stands and begins pacing the living room. I remain on the couch and watch him as he works to gather his thoughts. He eventually pauses and locks his hands behind his head.
I had no right to question you about that guy either. I don't allow you to question me or my life, so I have no right to question yours.
Not about to argue with that logic.
I just don't know how to deal with this thing between us.
He steps closer to me and I stand up. He wraps his arms around my shoulders and holds me against his chest.
I don't know an easy or even polite way to say this, but what I said to Corbin is the truth. I'll never love anyone again. It's not worth it to me. But I'm being unfair to you. I know I'm messing with your head and I know I've hurt you and I'm sorry for that. I just like being with you. But every time I'm with you, I'm scared you're seeing it for more than it really is.
I know I should have some sort of reaction to everything he just said, but I'm still processing his words. Every single one of his admissions should be a red flag, since they were all also coupled with the hard truth that he doesn't plan on loving me or having a relationship with me. But the red flag doesn't rise. The green one does. Is it me specifically you don't want to love, or is it love in general you don't want to experience? He pulls me away from his chest so he can look at me while he answers my question.
It's love in general I don't want, Tate. Ever. It's you specifically that I just want.
I fall in and out and back in love with that answer. I'm so screwed up. Everything he says should send me running, but instead it makes me want to wrap my arms around him and give him whatever it is he's willing to take from me. I'm lying to him, and I'm lying to myself, and I'm not doing either of us any good.
but I can't stop the words that come out of my mouth. I can handle this as long as it stays simple, I tell him. When you pull the shit you pulled a few weeks ago by walking away and slamming your door, that's not keeping it simple, Miles. Things like that make it complicated. He nods, contemplating what I've said.
Simple, he says, rolling the word around in his mouth. If you can do simple, I can do simple.
Good, I say. And when it becomes too hard for either of us, we'll end it for good.
I'm not worried about it becoming too hard for me, he says. I'm worried about it becoming too hard for you.
I'm worried about me too, Miles. But I want the here and now with you a whole lot more than I care about how it will affect me in the end. With that thought, I suddenly figure out what my one rule is. He's had his boundaries this entire time, protecting himself from the vulnerability that I've been subjected to. I think I finally have my one rule, I say. He looks at me and raises a brow, waiting for me to talk. Don't give me false hope for a future, I say, especially if you know in your heart we'll never have one. His posture immediately stiffens.
Have I done that? He asks, genuinely concerned. Have I given you false hope before?
Yes, about 30 minutes ago when you looked me in the eyes the entire time you were inside me.
No,
I say quickly. Just make sure you don't do or say things that would make me believe otherwise. As long as we both see this for what it is, I think we'll be fine. He stares at me silently for a while, studying me, evaluating my words.
I can't tell if you're really mature for your age or really delusional.
I shrug, guarding my delusions deep inside my chest. An unhealthy mixture of both, I'm sure. He presses his lips against the side of my head.
This feels really fucked up to say out loud, but I promise I won't give you hope for us, Tate.
My heart frowns at his words, but my face forces a smile. Good, I say. You have serious issues that kind of freak me out, and I'd much rather fall in love with an emotionally stable man someday. He laughs. Probably because he knows the odds of finding someone who can put up with this kind of relationship, if you can even call it that, are extremely low. Yet, somehow, the one girl who might be fine with it just happened to move in across the hall from him. And he actually likes her. You like me, Miles Archer. Corbin found out, I say, as I take what has become my usual seat next to Cap.
Uh-oh, he says. Is the boy still alive?
I nod. For now, not sure how long that'll last, though. The doors to the lobby open, and I watch Dylan make his way inside. He pulls a hat off his head and shakes rain out of it as he walks toward the elevator.
Sometimes I wish the flights I send up would crash, Cap says, eyeing Dylan.
I guess Cap doesn't like Dylan either. I'm beginning to feel a little bad for Dylan. He spots us just before he reaches the elevators. Cap is moving to press the up button, but Dylan reaches it before him.
I'm pretty capable of fetching my own elevator, old man, he says.
I vaguely remember having a brief thought 10 seconds ago about Dylan and how I felt sorry for him. I take that thought back now.
Dylan looks at me and winks.
What you doing, Tate?
Washing elephants, I say with a straight face. Dylan shoots me a confused look, not at all understanding my random response.
If you don't want a sarcastic answer, Cap says to him, don't ask a stupid question.
The elevator doors open, and Dylan rolls his eyes at both of us before walking onto the elevator. Cap cuts his eyes to mine, and he grins. He holds a palm up in the air, and I high-five him.
Chapter 24. Miles. 6 years earlier. Why is everything yellow? My dad is standing in the doorway to Rachel's bedroom, looking at the few items we've collected in the months since he's known about the pregnancy. It looks like Big Bird threw up in here. Rachel laughs. She's standing at the bathroom mirror putting the finishing touches on her makeup. I've been lying on her bed watching her. We don't want to know if it's a boy or a girl, so we're buying gender-neutral colors. Rachel answers my dad's question as if it were one of many, but we both know it's the first. He hasn't asked about the pregnancy. He doesn't ask about our plans. He usually leaves the room if Rachel and I are both in it. Lisa isn't much different. She's not past the point of disappointment or sadness yet, so we don't push it. It'll take time, so Rachel and I are giving that to them. Right now, Rachel only has me to talk to about the baby, and I only have her, and even though that seems like too little, it's more than enough for the both of us. How long will the ceremony last? My dad asks me. No more than 2 hours, I tell him. He says we should go. I tell him that as soon as Rachel is ready, we can go. Rachel says she's ready. We go. Congratulations, I tell Rachel. Congratulations, she tells me. We both graduated 3 hours ago. Now we're lying on my bed thinking about our next step, or at least I am, anyway. Let's move in together, I tell her. She laughs. We already kind of live together, Miles, she points out. I shake my head. You know what I mean. I know we already have plans for after we start college in August, but I think we should do it now. She rises up on her elbow and looks at me, probably trying to read my expression to see if I'm serious. How? Where would we go? I reach over to my nightstand and open the top drawer. I pull out the letter and hand it to her. She begins reading it out loud. Dear Mr. Archer, she looks up at me and her eyes are wide. Congratulations on your summer registration. We are pleased to inform you that your application for family housing has been processed and approved. Rachel smiles. Enclosed, you will find a return envelope and the final paperwork, which will need to be returned by the postmark date. Rachel looks at the envelope and quickly flips through the attached paperwork. She pulls the letter back to the top. We look forward to receiving the completed forms. Our contact information is below. Should you have any questions, sincerely, Paige Donahue, Registrar. Rachel covers her smile with her hand and tosses the letter aside, then leans forward and hugs me. We get to move now, she says. I love how evident the excitement is in her voice. I tell her yes. Rachel is relieved. She knows as well as I do how awkward the next several weeks would have been in the same house as our parents. Have you asked your father yet? I tell her she forgets that we're adults now. We no longer have to ask for permission. We only have to inform. Rachel says she wants to inform them right now. I take Rachel's hand and we walk together to the living room and inform our parents that we are moving out together.
Chapter 25. Tate. It's been a few weeks since Corbin found out. He hasn't accepted it, and he still hasn't spoken to Miles, but he's beginning to adapt. He knows on the nights I leave without explanation, only to come back a few hours later, where I've been. He doesn't ask. As far as things with Miles, I'm the one doing the adapting. I've had to adapt to his rules because there's no way Miles is adapting to breaking them. I've learned to stop trying to figure him out and to stop allowing things to get so tense between us. We're doing exactly what we agreed to do in the beginning, which was to have sex. A lot of sex. Shower sex, bedroom sex, floor sex, kitchen table sex. I've still never spent the night with him. And it still hurts sometimes how closed off he becomes right after it's over. But I still haven't figured out a way to say no to him. I know I want so much more than what he's giving me, and he wants so much less than what I want to give him. But we're both just taking what we can get for now. I try not to think about what will happen the day I can't handle it anymore.
I try not to think about all the other things I'm sacrificing by still being involved with him. I try not to think about it at all, but the thoughts still come. Every night when I'm in bed, I think about it. Every time I'm in the shower, I think about it. When I'm in class, in the living room, in the kitchen, at work, I think about what's going to happen when one of us finally comes to our senses.
Is Tate a nickname for something else? Miles asks me.
We're in his bed. He just got home from 4 days at work, and even though our arrangement is supposed to be all about sex, we're still fully dressed. We're not making out. He's just lying with me, asking me personal questions about my name, and I love it so much more than any other day we've ever spent together. It's the first time he's ever asked me a semi-personal question. I hate that his question fills me with all these feelings of hope, and all he did was ask me if Tate was a nickname. Tate is my middle name, I say. It was my grandmother's maiden name.
What's your first name?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Tate Collins, he says,
making love to my name with his voice. My name has never sounded as beautiful as it did just now coming out of his mouth.
That's almost twice as many syllables as my name, he says. That's a lot of syllables.
What's your middle name?
Mikkel, he says. People always mispronounce it and say Michael, though. Gets annoying.
Miles Mikkel Archer, I say. That's a strong name. Miles rises onto his elbow and looks down at me with a peaceful expression. He brushes my hair behind my ear as his eyes roam over my face.
Anything interesting happened this week while I was working, Elizabeth Tate Collins?
There's a playfulness in his voice, one that I'm not familiar with, but I like it. I like it a lot. Not really, Miles Mikkel Archer, I say, smiling. I worked a lot of overtime.
Do you still like your job?
His fingers are touching my face, sliding across my lips, trailing down my neck. I do like it, I say. Do you like being a captain? I just throw versions of his own questions back at him. I figure it's safe that way because I know he'll only give what he's willing to take. Miles follows his hand with his eyes as he unbuttons the top button of my shirt.
I love my job, Tate.
His fingers work on the second button of my shirt.
I just don't like being gone so much, especially knowing you're right across the hall from where I live. It makes me want to be home all the time.
I try to contain it, but I can't. His words make me gasp, even though it was probably the quietest gasp to ever pass anyone's lips. But he notices. His eyes meet mine in a flash, and I can see him wanting to backpedal. He wants to take back what he just said, because there was hope in those words. Miles doesn't say things like that. I know he's about to apologize. He's going to remind me that he can't love me, that he didn't mean to give me that inkling of false hope.
Don't take it back, Miles. Please, let me keep that.
Our eyes remain locked for several long seconds. I continue to stare up at him, waiting for the take back. His fingers are still on the second button of my shirt, but they're not attempting to unbutton it anymore. He focuses on my mouth, then back to my eyes again, then back to my mouth.
Tate,
he whispers. He says my name so softly I'm not even sure if his mouth moves. I don't have time to respond. His hand leaves the button of my shirt and slides through my hair at the same moment as his lips connect fiercely with mine. He slides his body on top of me, and his kiss instantly becomes intense, deep, dominating. His kiss is full of something that's never been there before, full of feeling, full of hope. Until this moment, I thought a kiss was a kiss was a kiss. I had no idea kisses could mean different things and feel so completely opposite from one another. In the past, I've always felt passion and desire and lust. But this time, it's different. This kiss is a different Miles, and I know in my heart that it's the real Miles, the Miles he used to be. The Miles I'm not allowed to ask about. He rolls off of me when he's finished. I stare up at the ceiling. My head is full of so many questions. My heart is full of confusion. This thing between us has never been easy. One would think limiting oneself to just sex would be the simplest thing in the world. But it makes me question every move and every word that comes out of my mouth. I find myself analyzing every look he gives me. I don't even know what move I'm supposed to make next. Do I lie here until he asks me to leave? I've never stayed the night with him before. Do I roll over and put my arms around him, hoping he'll hold me in return until we fall asleep? I'm too scared he'll reject me. I'm stupid. I'm a stupid, stupid girl. Why can't this just be sex for me, too? Why can't I come over here, give him what he wants, get what I want, and leave? I roll onto my side and slowly sit up. I reach down for my clothes, then stand up and dress myself. He's watching me. He's quiet. I avoid looking at him until I'm fully dressed and slipping on my shoes. As much as I want to crawl back into the bed with him, I walk toward the door instead. I don't turn around to face him when I say, "See you tomorrow, Miles." I make it all the way to his front door. He doesn't speak. He doesn't tell me he'll see me tomorrow, and he doesn't tell me goodbye. I'm hoping his silence is proof that he doesn't like how it feels to be walked away from. I open the door and walk across the hall and into my apartment. Corbin is seated on the couch watching TV. He glances up at the door when he hears me enter, then shoots me a condescending look of disapproval. "Lighten up," I say as I make my way inside. I slip off my shoes by the door. "You have to get over this eventually." I see him shake his head, but I ignore it and walk toward my bedroom. "He was screwing you behind my back and lying to me," Corbin says. "That's not something I'll get over." I face the living room again and see that Corbin is looking at me. "Did you expect him to be open with you about it? My God, Corbin, you kicked Dylan out of your apartment for looking at me the wrong way." Corbin stands up angry now. "Exactly," he shouts. "I thought Miles was protecting you from Dylan when in reality he was laying claim. He's a goddamn hypocrite, and I'll be pissed at him for as long as I want to be pissed at him, so you get over it." I laugh, because Corbin has no right to point fingers. "What's funny, Tate?" he snaps. I walk back to the living room and stand directly in front of him. Miles has been nothing but honest with me about what he wants. He hasn't once fed me a line of bullshit. "I'm the only girl he's been with in 6 years, and you're going to call him a hypocrite?" I don't even try to keep my voice down anymore. "You might want to look in the mirror, Corbin. How many girls have you been with since I've moved in here? How many of them do you think have brothers who would love to kick your ass if they found out about you? If anyone's the hypocrite here, it's you." His hands are on his hips, and he's watching me with a hardened look in his eyes. When he fails to respond, I turn to walk back toward my room, but the front door opens with a knock. Miles. Corbin and I both turn just as he peeks his head inside. "Everything good over here?" he asks, stepping into the living room. I glance at Corbin, and Corbin glares at me. I arch an eyebrow, waiting for him to respond to the question Miles posed, since he's the one with the issue.
"You okay, Tate?"
Miles asks, addressing only me now. I look back over at him and nod. "I'm fine," I say. I'm not the one with unrealistic expectations of my sibling. Corbin groans loudly, then turns around and kicks the couch. Miles and I watch him as he slides his hands through his hair and grips the back of his neck tightly. He turns to face Miles again, then exhales heavily.
"Why couldn't you have just been gay?"
Miles looks at him with careful concentration, I'm waiting for either of them to have a reaction so I'll know whether or not I can breathe. Miles begins to shake his head as soon as a smile appears on his face. Corbin starts to laugh, but he groans at the same time, indicating that he just came to terms with our arrangement, even though he still may not agree with it. I smile and walk quietly out of the apartment, hoping they're about to mend whatever was broken between them when I stepped into the picture. The elevator doors open on the lobby level, and I'm prepared to step off, but Cap is poised in front of them as if he's about to step on.
"You coming for me?" he asks.
I nod and point upward. Corbin and Miles are working things out upstairs. I was giving them a minute. Cap steps into the elevator and presses the button for the 20th floor.
"Well, I suppose you can walk me home," he says.
He grabs the bars behind him for support. I stand next to him and lean against the wall behind me. "Can I ask you a question, Cap?" He gives me the all clear with a nod.
"I love being asked them as much as I love asking them."
I look down at my shoes, crossing one foot over the other. "What do you think would make a man never want to experience love again?" Cap doesn't answer my question for at least 5 floors. I eventually look at him, and he's looking right at me, his eyes narrowed, producing even more wrinkles between them.
"I suppose if a man lived through the ugliest side of love, he might never want to experience it again."
I contemplate his answer, but it doesn't help much. I don't see how love could get ugly enough for a person to just shut himself off from it completely. The elevator doors open to the 20th floor, and I let him step off first. I walk with him to his apartment door and wait for him to open it.
"Tate,"
he says. He's facing his door, and he doesn't turn around to finish his sentence.
"Sometimes a man's spirit just ain't strong enough to withstand the ghosts from his past."
He opens his apartment door and walks inside.
"Maybe that boy just lost his spirit somewhere along the way."
He closes his door and leaves me attempting to decipher even more confusion.
Chapter 26, Miles. 6 years earlier. My room is Rachel's now. Rachel's room is my room. We graduated. We moved in together. We're in college now. See? We've got this. Ian brings in the last of the boxes from the car. "Where do you want this one?" he asks. "What is it?" Rachel asks him. He tells her it looks like a box full of her bras and underwear. She laughs and tells him to set it next to my dresser. Ian does. Ian likes Rachel. Ian likes that she's not holding me back. Ian likes that she wants me to get my degree and finish flight school. Rachel wants me to be happy. I tell Rachel I'll be happy as long as I have her. She tells me, "Then you'll always be happy." My dad still hates me. My dad doesn't want to hate me. They're trying to accept it, but it's hard. It's hard for everyone. Rachel doesn't care what everyone thinks. She only cares what I think, and I only think about Rachel. I'm learning that no matter how difficult a situation is, people learn how to adapt to it. My dad and her mom may not approve, but they'll adapt. Rachel may not be ready to be a mom, and I may not be ready to be a dad, but we're adapting. It's what has to happen. If people want peace within themselves, it's necessary. Vital, even. Miles. I love my name when it comes out of her mouth. She doesn't waste it. She only says it when she needs something. She only says it when it needs to be said. Miles. She said it twice. She must really need something. I roll over and she's sitting up in bed. She looks at me wide-eyed. Miles. 3 times. Miles. 4. It hurts. Shit. I jump out of bed and grab our bag. I help Rachel change clothes. I help her to the car. She's scared. I might be more scared than she is. I hold her hand while we drive. I tell her to breathe. I don't know why I tell her this. Of course, she knows to breathe. I don't know what else to tell her. I feel helpless. Maybe she wants her mom. Do you want me to call them? She shakes her head. Not yet, she says. After. She just wants it to be us. I like this. I just want it to be us, too. A nurse helps her out of the car. They take us to a room. I get Rachel whatever she needs. Do you need ice? I get it for her. Do you want a cold rag? I get it for her. Do you want me to turn off the TV? I turn it off. Do you want another blanket, Rachel? You look cold. I don't get her a blanket. She's not cold. Do you want more ice? She doesn't want more ice. She wants me to shut up. I shut up. Give me your hand, Miles. I give it to her. I want it back. She's hurting it. I let her keep it anyway. She's quiet. She never makes a sound. She just breathes. It's incredible. I'm crying. I don't know why. I love you so goddamn much, Rachel. The doctor tells her she's almost done. I kiss her on the forehead. It happens. I'm a dad. She's a mom. It's a boy, the doctor says. She's holding him. She's holding my heart. He stops crying. He tries to open his eyes. Rachel cries. Rachel laughs. Rachel tells me thank you. Rachel tells me thank you. Like she wasn't the one who created this. Rachel is crazy. I love him so much, Miles, she says. She's still crying. I love him so, so much. I love him too, I tell her. I touch him. I want to hold him, but I want her to hold him even more. She looks beautiful holding him. Rachel looks up at me. Will you please tell me his name now? I was hoping he would be a boy so I could have this moment. I was hoping I could tell her what her son's name is because I know she'll love it. I hope she remembers the moment she became my everything. Miles is going to show you the way to Mr. Clayton's class, Rachel. His name is Clayton. She begins to sob. She remembers. It's perfect, she says, her words mixed with tears. She's crying too hard now. She wants me to hold him. I sit on the bed with her and take him. I'm holding him. I'm holding my son. Rachel rests her head on my arm and we stare at him. We stare at him for so long. I tell Rachel he has her red hair. Rachel says he has my lips. I tell Rachel I hope he has her personality. She disagrees and says she hopes he's just like me. He makes life so much better, she says. He sure does. We're so lucky, Miles. We sure are. Rachel squeezes my hand. We've got this, Rachel whispers. We've so got this, I tell her. Clayton yawns and it makes us both laugh. Since when did yawns become so incredible? I touch his fingers. We love you so much, Clayton.
Chapter 27. Tate. I drop down into the chair beside Cap, still dressed from head to toe in my scrubs. As soon as I got home from work, I studied for 2 hours straight. It's already after 10, and I haven't even had supper yet, which is why I'm sitting next to Cap right now, because he's getting to know my habits and had a pizza ordered for the two of us. I hand him a slice and grab my own, then shut the lid and set it on the floor in front of me. I shove a huge bite into my mouth, but Cap is staring down at the slice in his hand.
It's really sad when pizza can make it to you faster than the police, he says. I just ordered this 10 minutes ago.
He takes a bite and closes his eyes like it's the best thing he's ever tasted. We both finish our slices and I reach for another one. He shakes his head when I offer him a second slice, so I put it back in the box.
So,
he says. Any progress between the boy and his friend?
It makes me laugh that he constantly refers to Miles as the boy. I nod and respond with a mouthful.
Kind of, I say. They had a successful game night, but I think it was only successful because Miles pretended I wasn't there the whole time.
I know he's trying to respect Corbin, but it kind of makes me feel like shit in the process, you know?
Cap nods like he understands.
I'm not sure that he does, but I like that he always listens so attentively anyway. Of course, he texted me the entire time he was in the living room sitting next to Corbin. So I guess I have that. But then there are weeks like this week, when he's not even in the same state, and it's like I don't even exist to him. No texts, no phone calls. I'm pretty sure he only thinks about me when I'm within 10 feet of him.
Cap shakes his head. I doubt that. I bet that boy thinks about you a lot more than he lets on.
I'd like to believe those words to be true, but I'm not so sure they are.
But if he doesn't, Cap says, you can't be mad at him for it. Wasn't part of the agreement now, was it?
I roll my eyes. I hate that he always brings me back to the fact that Miles isn't the one breaking rules or agreements. I'm the one with the problems in our arrangement, and that's no one's fault but my own. How did I get myself into this mess? I ask, not even needing an answer. I know how I got myself into this mess. I also know how to get out of it. I just don't want to.
You ever heard that expression, when life gives you lemons?
Make lemonade, I say, finishing his quote. Cap looks at me and shakes his head.
That's not how it goes, he says. When life gives you lemons, make sure you know whose eyes you need to squeeze them in.
I laugh, grab another slice of pizza, and wonder how in the hell I ended up with an 80-year-old man as my best friend. Corbin's home phone never rings, especially after midnight. I throw the covers off and grab a t-shirt, then pull it over my head. I don't know why I bother getting dressed. Corbin's gone and Miles isn't due back until tomorrow. I make it to the kitchen on the 5th ring, right as the answering machine picks up. I canceled the message, then put the phone to my ear. Hello?
Tate, my mother says. Oh my God, Tate.
Her voice is panicked, which immediately causes me to panic. What is it?
A plane. A plane crashed about half an hour ago, and I can't get through to the airline. Have you talked to your brother?
My knees meet the floor. Are you sure it was his airline? I ask her. My voice sounds so terrified, I don't even recognize it. It sounds as terrified as hers did the last time this happened. I was only 6, but I remember every single detail as if it happened yesterday, down to the moon and stars pajamas I was wearing. My father was on a domestic flight, and we had turned on the news right after dinner and saw that one of the planes had gone down due to engine failure. Everyone on board was killed. I remember watching my mother on the phone with the airline, hysterical, trying to find out information on who the pilot was. We found out it wasn't him within the hour, but that hour was one of the scariest of our lives. Until now. I rush to my room and grab my cell phone off my nightstand and immediately dial his number.
Have you tried calling him?
I ask my mother as I make my way back to the living room. I try to make it to the couch, but for some reason, the floor seems more comforting. I kneel down again, almost as if I'm in prayer mode. I guess I am.
Yes, I've been calling his phone non-stop. It's just going to voicemail.
It's a stupid question. Of course, she's tried calling him. I try again anyway, but his phone goes directly to voicemail. I try to reassure her, but I know it's pointless. Until we hear his voice, reassurance won't help. I'll call the airline, I tell her. I'll call you back if I hear anything. She doesn't even say goodbye. I use the home phone to call the airline and my cell phone to call Miles. It's the first time I've ever dialed his number. I pray that he answers because as much as I'm scared to death for Corbin, it's also running through my head that Miles works for the same airline. My stomach is sick.
Hello?
Miles says on the second ring. His voice sounds hesitant, like he's unsure why I'm calling. Miles, I say, both frantic and relieved. Is he okay? Is Corbin okay? There's a pause. Why is there a pause?
What do you mean?
A plane, I say immediately. My mom called. There was a plane crash. He's not answering his phone.
Where are you? He says quickly.
The apartment?
Let me in.
I walk to the door and unlock it. He pushes the door open and still has the phone to his ear. When he sees me, he pulls the phone away, immediately rushes to the couch, grabs the remote, and turns on the television. He flips through the channels until he finds the TV news report. He dials numbers on his cell phone, then turns and rushes toward me. He takes my hand in his.
Come here, he says, pulling me to him. I'm sure he's fine.
I nod against his chest, but his reassurance is pointless.
Gary,
he says when someone answers on the other end.
It's Miles. Yeah. Yeah, I heard, he says. Who was the crew?
There's a long pause. I'm terrified to look at him. Terrified.
Thank you.
He hangs up the phone.
He's okay, Tate,
he says immediately.
Corbin's fine. Ian, too.
I break down into tears of relief. Miles walks me to the couch and sits down, then pulls me to him. He takes my cell phone out of my hands and presses several buttons before putting the phone to his ear.
Hey, it's Miles. Corbin is fine.
He pauses for a few seconds.
Yeah, she's fine. I'll tell her to call you in the morning.
A few more seconds pass and he says goodbye. He sets the phone on the couch beside him.
Your mom.
I nod. I already knew. And that simple gesture, him calling my mother, just made me fall for him even harder. Now he's kissing the top of my head, rubbing his hand up and down my arm reassuringly. Thank you, Miles, I tell him. He doesn't say you're welcome because he doesn't think he did anything that deserves thanking. Did you know them? I ask. The crew on board?
No. They were out of a different hub. The names didn't sound familiar.
My phone vibrates, so Miles hands it back to me. I look at it, and it's a text from Corbin. Corbin, in case you've heard about the plane, just want you to know I'm fine. I called headquarters, and Miles is, too. Please let Mom know if she hears about it. Love you. Receiving his text fills me with even more relief now that I know with 100% certainty that he's okay. It's a text from Corbin, I tell Miles. He says you're okay, in case you were worried.
Miles laughs. So he checked up on me, he says with a grin. I knew he couldn't hate me forever.
I smile. I love that Corbin wanted me to know that Miles was okay. Miles continues to hold me, and I savor every second of it.
When is he scheduled to come home?
Not for 2 more days, I say. How long have you been home?
About 2 minutes, he says. I had just plugged my phone into charge when you called.
I'm glad you're back. He doesn't respond. He doesn't tell me he's glad to be back. Instead of saying something that might give me false hope, he just kisses me.
You know, he says, pulling me onto his lap. I hate the circumstances surrounding the reason you probably didn't have time to put on pants, but I love that you don't have on pants.
His hands slide up my thighs, and he pulls me closer until we're flush together. He kisses the tip of my nose, then kisses my chin. Miles, I run my hands through his hair and down his neck, then pause with them on his shoulders. I was also scared it could have been you, I whisper. That's why I'm glad you're back.
His eyes grow soft and the worry lines between them disappear. I may not know anything about his past or his life, but I definitely notice that he hasn't called anyone to let them know he's okay. That makes me sad for him. His eyes fall away from mine and land on my chest. He fingers the bottom edges of my shirt, then slowly pulls it over my head. I have nothing but a pair of panties on now. He leans forward, wraps his arms around my back, and pulls me against his mouth. His lips close softly over my nipple and my eyes shut involuntarily. Chills erupt over my skin as his hands begin to explore every bare part of my back and my thighs. His mouth works its way to my other breast just as his hands slip inside my panties at my hips.
I think I have to rip these off you, because I sure don't want you to move off my lap, he says.
I smile. Fine with me. I have more where these came from. I can feel him grin against my skin as his hands pull at the elastic band of my underwear. He pulls on one side but fails to tear them. He tries ripping the other side to pull them off me, but nothing gives. You're giving me a wedgie, I say, laughing. He lets out a frustrated sigh. It's always so much sexier when they do this on TV. I readjust myself and sit up straighter. Try it again, I encourage. You can do it, Miles. He grabs the left side of my panties and yanks them hard. Ouch, I yell, scooting in the direction of his pull to lessen the pain of the elastic digging into my right side. He laughs again and drops his face to my neck. Sorry, he says. Got any scissors? I cringe at the thought of him coming at me with a pair of scissors. I scoot off of him and stand up, then pull my underwear down, kicking them off and away from me.
Watching you do that was totally worth my failed attempt at being sexy, he says.
I smile. Your failed attempt at being sexy actually made you sexy. My comment makes him laugh again. I walk toward him and climb back onto his lap. He repositions me so that I'm straddling him again.
My failures are a turn-on for you? He asks teasingly. Oh, yeah, I murmur.
So hot. His hands are on me again, roaming across my back and down my arms.
You would have loved me from the ages of 13 to 16, he says. I failed at pretty much everything, especially football.
I grin. Now we're talking. Tell me more.
Baseball, he says, right before he presses his mouth to my neck.
He kisses his way up to my ear.
And one semester of world geography. Holy shit, I moan. Now that's hot.
He moves his lips to my mouth and pulls me in for a soft kiss. He barely touches his mouth to mine.
I failed at kissing, too. Terribly. I almost choked a girl with my tongue once.
I laugh.
Want me to show you?
As soon as I nod, he's repositioning us on the couch until I'm lying on my back and he's on top of me.
Open your mouth.
I open it. He drops his mouth to mine and shoves his tongue inside, giving me what is quite possibly the worst kiss I've ever experienced. I push against his chest, attempting to get his tongue out of my mouth, but he doesn't budge. I turn my face to the left, and he begins licking my cheek, causing me to laugh even harder. Oh my God, that was terrible, Miles. He pulls his mouth away and lowers himself on top of me.
I got better.
I nod. That's a fact, I say, agreeing wholeheartedly. We're both smiling. The relaxed look on his face fills me with so many emotions I can't even begin to classify them. I'm happy, because we're having fun together. I'm sad, because we're having fun together. I'm angry, because we're having fun together, and it makes me want so much more of this, so much more of him. We quietly stare at each other until he slowly dips his head, pressing a long kiss against my lips. He begins placing soft kisses all over my mouth, until the kisses become longer and more intense. His tongue eventually parts my lips and the playfulness disappears. It's quite serious now, as our kisses grow more hurried and his clothes begin to join mine on the floor, piece by piece.
"The couch or your bed?" he whispers.
"Both," I reply.
He obliges.
I fell asleep in my bed, next to Miles.
Neither of us has ever fallen asleep afterward before. One of us always leaves.
As much as I'm trying to convince myself that it means nothing, I know it does. Every time we're together, I get a little bit more of him. Whether it's a glimpse of his past, or time spent without the sex, or even time spent sleeping, he's giving me more and more of himself, little by little. I feel like this is both good and bad. It's good because I want and need so much more of him, so every little bit I get is enough to satisfy me when I begin worrying about everything I don't get from him. But it's also bad, because every time I get a little bit more of him, another part of him grows more distant. I can see it in his eyes. He's worried he's giving me hope, and I'm afraid he'll eventually just pull away completely. Everything with Miles will come crashing down. It's inevitable. He's so adamant about the things he doesn't want out of life, and I'm starting to understand just how serious he is. So as much as I try to protect my heart from him, it's pointless. He's going to break it eventually, yet I continue to allow him to fill it. Every time I'm with him, he fills my heart up more and more. And the more it's filled with pieces of him, the more painful it'll be when he rips it out of my chest as though it never belonged there in the first place. I hear the vibration of his phone and feel him roll over and reach for it on the nightstand next to him. He thinks I'm asleep, so I don't give him reason to think otherwise. "Hey," he whispers. There's a long pause, and I start to panic internally, wondering who he's talking to.
"Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have called you. I figured you'd be asleep."
My heart is in my throat now, crawling its way up, trying to escape from Miles and me and this entire situation. My heart knows by my reaction to this phone call that it's in trouble. My heart has just gone into fight-or-flight mode, and right now it's doing everything it can to run.
I don't blame my heart one bit. "Love you too, Dad."
My heart slides back down my throat and finds its normal home in my chest again. It's happy for now. I'm happy. Happy that he actually does have someone to call. In the same moment, I'm also reminded of how little I know about him, how little he shows me, how much he hides himself from me so that when I finally break, it won't be his fault. It won't be a quick break either. It'll be slow and painful, filled with so many moments like these that tear me up from the inside out. Moments when he thinks I'm asleep and he slides out of my bed. Moments when I keep my eyes closed but listen as he puts on his clothes. Moments when I make sure my breathing remains regular in case he's watching me when he leans over to kiss me on the forehead. Moments when he leaves, because he always leaves.
Chapter 28. Miles. 6 years earlier. "What if he turns out to be gay?" Rachel asks me. "Would that bother you?" She's holding Clayton, and we're both sitting on the hospital bed. I'm on the foot of the bed facing her, watching her stare at him. She keeps asking me random questions, playing devil's advocate again. She says we need to work these things out now so we don't run into any parenting issues in the future. "It would only bother me if he felt like he couldn't talk to us about it. I want him to know he can talk to us about anything." Rachel smiles at Clayton, but I know her smile is for me, because she loved my answer. "What if he doesn't believe in God?" she asks. "He can believe whatever he wants. I just want his beliefs, or lack thereof, to make him happy." She smiles again. "What if he commits an awful, heinous, heartless crime and gets sent to prison for life?" "I would question where I went wrong as a father," I tell her. She looks up at me. "Well, based on this interrogation, I'm convinced he'll never commit a crime because you're already the best dad I've ever known." Now she's making me smile. We both look at the door when it opens and a nurse walks in. She flashes a regretful smile. "It's time," she says. Rachel groans, but I have no idea what the nurse is referring to. Rachel sees the confusion on my face. His circumcision. My stomach clenches. I know we discussed this during the pregnancy, but I'm suddenly having second thoughts, knowing what he's about to go through. "It's not so bad," the nurse says. "We numb him first." She walks over to Rachel and begins to lift him from Rachel's arms, but I lean forward. "Wait," I tell her, "let me hold him first." The nurse backs up a step, and Rachel hands Clayton to me. I pull him in front of me and look down on him. "I'm so sorry, Clayton. I know it'll hurt, and I know it's emasculating, but..." "He's a day old," Rachel interjects with a laugh. "There's hardly anything that can emasculate him yet." I tell her to hush. I tell her I'm having a father-son moment, and she needs to pretend she's not here. "Don't worry. Your mom left the room," I say to Clayton, giving Rachel a wink. "I was saying, I know it's emasculating, but you'll thank me later for it, especially when you're older and you get involved with girls. Hopefully not until after you're 18, but it'll more than likely be around the age of 16. It was for me, anyway." Rachel leans forward and holds her arms out for him. "That's enough bonding," she says, laughing. "I think we need to review the boundaries of father-son conversation while he's being emasculated." I give him a quick kiss on his forehead and hand him back to Rachel. She does the same and passes him on to the nurse. We both watch as the nurse leaves the room with him. I look back at Rachel and crawl toward her until I'm lying next to her on the bed.